Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I saw my first dead show in the summer, July of 1984 at the Ventura County Fairgrounds, which was a wonderful place to see the dead because it was a it was a rodeo stall, basically, that was taken over by the heads and freaks. Essentially, the cops didn't come onto the parking lot or the various animal stalls and areas that people were camped out over the weekend. And I discovered, tripping around, so to speak, that behind the soundstage, which was in the middle of the rodeo, you couldn't see the stage. Which meant that the people who went to this particular spot were the crazy freak dancers. And I was initiated in that those early days into a certain current of crazy, trippy, dippy, noodly, bone dancing body movement that has stayed with me throughout my whole life as I've danced innumerable kinds of musics. And when I went to the 50th anniversary shows at Santa Clara not so long ago, after not seeing the dead or revisions of the dead, reformulations of the dead since the death of Jerry, with one or two exceptions, I found myself kind of hunting around in this vast sort of ugly coliseum for those spaces where you couldn't really see the stage, but the sound was decent. And so I had my little radar on, and I found it. I found this one little sneaky spot where there was like a triangle, like a pizza-shaped wedge of hippy-dippy freaky dancers. And I swear they were the same people. The same looks and the same eyes. And it was a really, you know, I think for like a lot of people, it was an extraordinarily emotional experience for me, not just because of my love of the Grateful Dead and the way the dead had functioned in my life, but the sense that in participating in that culture and initiating your body and your mind and your psyche and your soul into that culture, that there's a kind of current that you can dip into that is much larger than you, that flows in a way that I think for other kinds of people is the way that religion functions in their life. But part of the beauty of it is that it's not quite a religion. It's something else or something more, or something that's religion plus. I'm not really sure. And I want to talk about that today with our guest, Jesse Jarno, who just came out with a really stupendously wonderful book, Heads, A Biography of Psychedelic America. I have to say I was a little envious when I first came across this book because it's the story that I want to hear and also have enjoyed telling little tiny bits of, which is not so much the usual story of Terrence McKenna and Timothy Leary and all the big names. I mean, they're there, especially McKenna. But it's really a story of psychedelic culture, of the bit players in the scene. And Jesse covers an extraordinary wide range of tales and subcultures and scenes. And there are many wonderful characters who appear. And he does something really smart, which is to tune in on a couple of characters that, again, they're bit players. They're people that you wouldn't necessarily know unless you were kind of already in the scene or maybe wouldn't know at all. Some of them are pretty obscure, depending on whether you were on the West Coast or the East Coast or the UK or whatever. And he follows them through this vast tapestry of sub-stories. Characters like Sarah Matzer, who's a Guatemalan quilter and an underground LSD chemist, and the amazing Chad Stickey, whose LSD ohms I was familiar with, but just had never heard the story of, and really how important these psychedelic taggers and graffiti writers were pretty early on, you know, in the early 70s in the Bronx, kind of paralleling a lot of the stories that we've also, heard of African-American taggers and writers early on in the day. So there's all these remarkable characters in it. But best of all, and this is where my envy disappeared because I was so happy, that Jesse wrote this thing in an exuberant, goofy, rich, funny, wink-wink style that draws much more from the legacy of the underground press and alternative newspapers and, you know, fanzines than it does from any kind of academic or mainstream kind of history. And there's a sort of deliriously sloppy excess to it that actually brought on, you know, physical memories of entering into what he calls Shakedown Street, those zones around Grateful Dead and other kinds of related concerts where, you know, people were selling, you know, grilled cheese and tie-dye and, you know, God knows what compounds. And there's a weird otherworldly parallel slipstream quality to it that his prose actually evoked for me multiple times throughout the reading. And so while the, you know, the academic nitpicking historian of me could have used a little bit more fact-checking, I also realized that that is really kind of impossible with this kind of story. Having written some stories and researched some stories about the underground, about psychedelics and the weird worlds that it creates, it's really an impossible task because there's just one swirling layer upon one swirling layer, and at some point you just stop at the latest person's lore and say, okay, I'm going to call it a day and move on. It's an inevitably labyrinthine Hall of Mirrors kind of story, and that Jesse was able to sustain it for 400 pages and to cover, you know, mid-60s esoterica with the acuity and breadth that he covers the 90s and the 2000s is really a remarkable feat. So anyone interested in the show, I really strongly recommend you get this book, not just for the lore and the stories and the information, and I learned lots of little tidbits that brought a huge smile to my face, but also it's just itself an artifact of the vibe. And so, you know, go for it. So, and with, you know, that just fulsome praise at your feet, Jesse, I invite you onto Expanding Mind.
Cool. Thank you so much for having me, Eric. It really means a lot to me. And thank you so much for the nice words. I appreciate it.
Let's start with this question about the particular weird. You know, you've written another book. You wrote a book about Yola Tango, you know, important band in my life from being a, you know, rock critic in New York in the 90s. And you know, you've written tons of journalism. But there's something particular that happens, both wonderful and challenging, again, when you write countercultural stories, especially when you get down to nitty-gritty of acid distribution networks, things that are, you know, excessively illegal, and the fact that there's so much lore and shifting tales and scrambled memories. It's really quite a daunting task. So I'd love to hear a little bit about how you kept sane, how you followed the bouncing ball, like how you kind of organized and then wove your way through this mass of kind of resonating labyrinthine material.
Sure. Well, so there were kind of, I guess, two aspects to that. I mean, one was kind of the organizational research aspect where I kind of kept lots of different files, just really strictly as chronologically as I could, and tried to just sort of create this sort of matrix of facts at my disposal. And so then when going out and interviewing people, you know, these stories are blurry, they're misty. You know, some people are very confident that they have the entire story and they're the people who, you know, who should be telling it. There are other people who are just like, oh yeah, I know like this bit and this bit. So like trying to put those things together was definitely a challenge. And, you know, trying to, you know, sort of keep my wits about me and like, okay, you know, what is each person's stake in this story? You know, how are they perceiving it? How do they fit into the rest of it? And that sort of that narrative voice that I ended up taking on for this project really had a lot to do with that as well. With, I guess, just sort of trying to keep the ability to keep some things a little bit at arm's length from, I guess, sort of from the narrative and, you know, sort of acknowledging that some things are, you know, facts and some things are, you know, almost facts, you know, something not quite myth, not quite lore. But yeah, I really wanted, you know, you described that, articulated that very well before, that is sort of about that feeling of kind of stepping into kind of the countercultural currents. And I came into it kind of more through the literature at first. I saw The Dead, I guess, when I was like 16 or 17, which was like 10 years after your first show. But for me, I had already read a bunch about kind of that world, and my parents, you know, own the Whole Earth catalog, and my dad is a psychedelic animator and all that. So I was sort of born into it in that way. But there was also, in my teen years and going into college, kind of this slow sort of come on, this slow awareness of those countercultural currents, until at one point I realized it's like, oh, that's sort of the world that I'm standing in the middle of. And this was kind of the late 90s, early 2000s for me when I was in high school and college, which turned out to be like the second peak of psychedelics in this country in terms of, you know, their availability. And I just really wanted to be able to connect, you know, the Electric Kool-Aid acid test and all these, you know, sort of classic accounts of the 60s to sort of what I experienced much, much later, and what you sort of experienced kind of in between those two points, which is this, you know, continuous culture that never stopped, that really has, you know, it leads from one character to another character to another character. And there's you know, dozens, if not hundreds, if not thousands of different paths you can take through that. And the place where I happened to enter the culture was kind of through the Grateful Dead world. And, you know, because of that, I think I probably have a little bit of a bias, but it seemed like a really good way to sort of to focus all these things and find this thread between characters who are, you know, sort of, you mentioned Sarah Mapser before, who is an underground chemist and a quilter, but to be able to connect her to people like the scientists at the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab in the early 70s who were, you know, raving deadheads, you know, using kind of the ARPANET, using the proto internet to, you know, trade set lists and accumulate lyrics, and to be able to then connect them to, like, you know, Keith Haring, the pop artist who passed through the Dead scene in a really, you know, in a way that turned out to be really important to him. It just seemed like such a unifying thing. And it remains that. It just, even now, like, I just went and saw that Dead and Company band a couple weekends ago. And it's amazing to me just sort of how much of a unifying vibe that the Dead world really creates between, you know, teenagers and people who are sort of out on their first quest, their first quests in the universe, and, you know, people who've been doing it since the 60s, and people who are, you know, way into avant-garde and weirdo music, and people who couldn't care less about that stuff. And it's just this big umbrella, and which is, you know, this big tent, whatever metaphor you want to use, that's just so intimately connected with psychedelics that it's, that's sort of where I went with it.
Yeah, and you also chose, and because it's a good time for these kinds of revelations and details, that and I admire you for not taking the easier way out of just kind of referring loosely in a wink wink kind of way to the way in which the Dead scene was thoroughly imbricated with the acid distribution network. And instead, you really, you know, you got down to some historical brass tacks, and without obviously naming names beyond anything that would get anybody in trouble or just overly speculating. You also tell a history of the material itself as it gets distributed, as it appears on different kinds of media. As that media itself causes certain kinds of problems, you talk about the way that the carrier weight laws, radically distorted the sentencing for LSD dealers, in the 80s and 90s, and so you really, you know, are also telling us a history of the material side of the drugs, as well as the kind of phenomenology they have on in people and how that changes culture. And that obviously adds a lot of interest to the thing. Did that make sense to you? Did you have to kind of decide to do that in a way that maybe was a little bit wary? Where did you get sort of a support from that? I mean, I know one of your great sources here is the wonderful Mark McLeod, who's a good friend of mine and has, you know, an elephant's memory, yeah. As well as a very tricksy way of laying out the facts. Right. And he's one of your, you know, your sources. But talk to me a little bit about, you know, whatever, the decision and then the work of really trying to track some of the nitty-gritty terms of the LSD.
Yeah, so I mean, so that was one of the central arcs that I knew about kind of going into the project that I sort of struck, you know, was planning to structure the thing around, which was that when Jerry Garcia died, LSD distribution in this country began to sort of drop off this cliff. And then there were a couple other factors around the turn of the century where it just sort of bottomed off even more. And that seemed like a really natural, like, end point to me, sort of going in, and I kind of wanted to sort of sort out the specifics of that. And yeah, Mark McLeod was such an essential source in terms of storytelling and lore. And Mark has a very sort of, you know, coded, dense way of getting some of these stories across, which then required a lot of sort of further triangulation on my part. Like, okay, is this person that he refers to by this name, are they the same as this person that got busted at this time, you know, in this city? And eventually I was able to kind of like pick those things through and sort of figure out a couple of names, and not just from Mark, but from, you know, kind of poking through news stories, which are, you know, news stories about psychedelics as they get reported in kind of the mainstream media don't, you know, obviously tell the full story most of the time. A lot of the time it'll just be sort of a list of defendants, you know, and the weight or something, and it doesn't really get any deeper than that. So like a lot of that was then sort of just, you know, going into Google and figuring out who is still around, what names people are going under, that kind of thing. And then contacting these people and finding some kind of, you know, relationship with them and conveying to them that this was a story that I think is really important and significant in the grander scheme of American history and global history, and that, you know, what they did was important, and you know the stories that they have and the stories that they preserve should be put down in some sense. And I found a couple of people kind of through that sort of that method that were willing to kind of go on record and talk about this stuff. Some of them I just sort of kind of even bumbled into, but backed my way into almost accidentally, like the Parkies who hung out in Central Park from the 60s into the 90s, selling LSD and making graffiti. I really didn't even know about the LSD part of it initially. I was investigating LSD Ohm, Chad, the early graffiti artist, and ended up finding this thread of people who hung out in Central Park, including this pack of sort of early to mid 70s graffiti writers who turned out to be the East Coast West Coast connection, or a East Coast West Coast connection between Central Park and some representatives of what claimed to be the Brotherhood of Eternal Love. And, you know, I don't have any reason to doubt that. And I was kind of trying to find representatives of that part of the world, of sort of the foot soldier part of the psychedelic world, that could connect every point from the 60s up into the 90s, to find somebody who is a street dealer in the 60s and then the early 70s and then later on. And it took kind of, I think I probably found like the last link in that chain, which was some sort of somewhere in the middle, pretty late into the process. But that was sort of the goal, was to be able to sort of see how the network changed and how the practices evolved. There are things that, you know, I discovered, like, one of the standard moves of the Brotherhood of Eternal Love back in the 60s when they were moving Orange Sunshine around was to, you know, to cut your hair and to go, you know, completely incognito, to be able to sort of, you know, just walk through, you know, the airports of the world carrying whatever you needed to carry and not get stopped. And that was this piece of advice that manifested again and again through people I talked to from the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. That was things like that. And it is, you know, it's looked at one way, perhaps from the government's way, it's a crime syndicate. It's a history of a black market. But looked at from another way, from the perspective of the people who are doing it, the people who are selling LSD, according to everybody who ever talks about it, you know, the DEA talks about this and the people selling it talks about this. They're not like other drug dealers. They're not, you know, maybe some of them are, you know, stashing some money away and are okay with that, but almost universally they're in it to save the world. Like people who are moving massive amounts of psychedelics, you know, rarely go into that lightly. And that sort of finding that thread, that sort of that space between folklore and religion, kind of at the sort of the deep core of this ad hoc anarchistic distribution system, was something that was really, you know, something that I was looking for. And I wasn't quite sure what it was or what I was, you know, what was there, but that was, there's kind of, you know, there's sort of a glow at the center of the acid world. And that's, yeah. I guess that's sort of what I was pursuing.
It's very well timed. I mean, you know, recently we have two different documentaries, touching on the Brotherhood, the Sunshine Makers and Orange Sunshine. And they just tell different parts of the story that you also tell. And it's sort of interesting how that paradox of the sort of a mixture of a very, you know, pragmatic, underground, quote-unquote criminal network of a sort of parallel economy, a black market, is interwoven with what you call the sort of, you know, American psychedelic religion. And, you know, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that phrase. It's interesting. I was talking to a academic friend of mine who's written a little bit on the Dead. You know, there is a sort of burgeoning, or has been for a while, a burgeoning Grateful Dead academic world, and that you're well familiar with. And he was talking about giving one paper where he talked about the Dead as religion, and he got a lot of pushback, as academics say. People were saying, no, it's about spirituality, it's not about religion. And that, you know, it's a very complicated distinction, especially if you study religion, because people like to, you know, cut, splice hairs on it. But I think it's an important one, and then I think most people have a gut sense of what that difference is. And I, like you, think it's important to use the word religion and not just talk about spirituality, especially when we're talking about the Grateful Dead, but also about psychedelics. So I'd like to hear you flesh out, after all the research you've done and thinking about it and talking to people and hearing about their experiences, integrating your own experiences, experiences of your friends, how would you characterize this peculiar American psychedelic religion?
Yeah, well, it's something that's you know, non-dogmatic or almost anti-dogmatic, and I think that's something that's really kind of a characteristic thread that runs through all these different practices and kind of sort of sub-belief sets. One of the things that I keep going back to is that, you know, when people talk about ayahuasca and mushrooms and sort of other psychedelics, there's a lot of times, you know, borrowing or lifting or using practices that have been used for, you know, centuries, thousands of years. Whereas with LSD, this is a relatively new thing in the world, and it's almost like there was a blank slate that was kind of waiting to be, you know, filled in. And I do think religion is an appropriate term to describe that, because there are things that are stable about it. There is, you know, there is this sacrament, which is LSD, that creates this thing where there are practices that inevitably sort of unfold from that, where you have literally, you know, the duration of the trip and kind of these sort of like guidelines that develop, you know, things like set and setting and intention and just this sort of vocabulary that seems to very naturally arise out of psychedelics and out of LSD especially, where, you know, these concepts are things that come up again and again across people who practice it in all different kinds of ways. You know, that's something that connects, like, you know, Leo Zeff to the Grateful Dead. There's a line in The Secret Chief where somebody is paraphrasing Leo Zeff, and it's, you know, it's, you know, if things start to get out of control for you, you know, focus on, you know, always keep, you know, you can put on music and focus on music and let that guide you and center you, which is like this exact mirror of the Grateful Dead lyric, you know, if you get confused, listen to the music play, which is, you know, this, you know, almost universal piece of psychedelic wisdom within the Grateful Dead belief set.
Yeah, and I think you did a great job also of emphasizing that aspect about the Dead's lyrics. At one point you have it explicitly where John Barlow and Robert Hunter, the lyricists, sit down and they start going, wow, man, this is like kind of turning into a cult. And they're like, okay, let's just make sure that when we write our lyrics that we don't put out any dogma. And of course, if you pay attention to their lyrics, the greatest lyrics that they write, there is this marvelous and sustaining kind of wisdom poetry that is at once deeply, quote-unquote, spiritual, or speaking to, like, our fundamental existential conditions and love and death and passing and memory. And at the same time, there's this kind of half playful and half a little dark, wink, wink, that nobody really knows what's going on, that it's a question mark within a question mark, and that nobody can really tell you anything. And I've always incredibly appreciated that sort of existential, if you will, quality of the Grateful Dead religion, or to some degree the psychedelic religion, particularly in contrast to some of the things you see now around ayahuasca, which are, I think, you know, very helpful for some people, but I find as more of a head, somewhat troubling. And you do a great job of that, and also just of weaving the lyrics into your own language in a way that kind of keeps a sort of resonance going with a lot of those insights. Well, but talking about this now, and talking about, since your book is really not so much about psychedelic America particularly as LSD America, and how the rise and fall of LSD in the midst of other compounds have indicated sort of shifts in the culture, where do you think LSD kind of stands now? Because, you know, most of the white coats who are now doing all these experiments on people in compounds, they don't usually look at LSD. They're usually working with psilocybin, they're working with MDMA, they're working even with DMT in the case of Strassman, that there's something short acting, it's easier to manage, you know, it takes less time, et cetera, but that also seems to indicate a little bit of shift away from this existential, modern, you know, singular LSD kind of focus that you really pay most attention to tracking. How do you think that's playing out now?
Yeah, there certainly has been this new kind of plurality of substances kind of in the conversation in the last 10 or 15 years especially. But, LSD is kind of the, you know, it's sort of like the American elder of that scene or something like that, where I do think it's still very present. And you're right, it is something that doesn't turn up in the research quite as much as substances that are a little more predictable or a little more short lasting, as you said. But it is, you know, there's some stuff with going on involving Beckley research in the UK involving LSD and synesthesia and studying ego dissolution. And then there's, you know, there's kind of, you know, the whole new move towards microdosing, which I think is actually very symbolic about where LSD is in this culture now, which is in the 60s and 70s, you know, the standard dose of LSD was, you know, 250 micrograms, which is definitely what, you know, people generally referred to as kind of like a god scene sized dose, whereas now there's the trend is towards literally a tiny fraction of that, and sort of exploring what LSD does on the small side, you know, just sort of in the where, you know, what it does when the cracks are open, you know, when it's just opening up very slightly for the user. But that said, I still see a lot of just straight up actual LSD use out in the wild. It's still one that, you know, because of that dosage, it's still one that has some kind of efficiency to it. But there's, you know, all kinds of 21st century complications to go along with that, you know, new kinds of you know, fake so-called synthetic LSD that's actually dangerous now sort of appearing on the market, masquerading as LSD. That's sort of terrifying. But over the last few years, kind of, I mean, I have no real definitive way to correlate this, but it really does seem like over the last few years, since that last Grateful Dead, you know, those 50th anniversary shows last summer, there has been this new wave of stuff on the market where LSD does seem as present, at least among heads, as you know, MDMA or other things do.
Yeah, that seems to be my impression as well. But I want to pick up on this microdosing thing and ask
you,
because I think to flesh out what the point you were just making is that the reason microdosing is kind of in the news, or we sort of pick up on it on a deeper level, I think has to do with this kind of issue of integration. One way of talking about that is how people, rather than looking at psychedelics as an entree into a parallel world that's still enchanted, that resists capital, or at least your ordinary day job world, that people are maybe not really operating in that mode anymore, and they actually are looking at these things as avenues towards just, you know, heightening their ability to get the job done. You know, so a lot of the people who are microdosing are taking it and going to work, doing work. They're coders, they're you know, whatever, video programmers, whatever they're doing. You know, it's greasing the wheels of this
right.
kind of weird moment of hyper-capitalist, neoliberal, post-industrial weirdness that we're all in, where one side is the other, and you know, the largest, creepiest corporation in the world are people who went to Burning Man and clearly must have tripped at some point. And it's very confusing, because the old map, like this, you know, the wonderful, you know, map that you use as a kind of leitmotif throughout the book, this Humbees revised map of the world that sort of maps the underground, like in a way it's everywhere and nowhere, and microdosing is a sign of that. And what that leads me to ask the question is something that is, again, something you talk about throughout the book, which is hip economics, and particularly, and this is the question I have for you, and you make this distinction, what is the difference between hip economics and hip capitalism?
Right.
There's something different there, and I'd love to hear you reflect on that.
Yeah, well, you know, hip economics is kind of this term that turned up around the Grateful Dead circles. Jerry Garcia uses it in that sort of that famous book-length interview, Signpost to New Space. And it's used to describe... He's using it to describe a small community, and the phrase he uses is, it's hip economics is moving money around really fast. It's as if, you know, the Grateful Dead get money, and then they use that to hire poster artists or people to make their instruments, and they keep that money within their community, and it moves around really, really quick. And the concept of it, as I understand it, was that it was a way to sort of pull in money from the outside world through the sort of the twin income streams of rock and roll and psychedelics, and using those two products really to then sort of fund this sort of utopian bubble inside of the broader world, inside of the broader American culture, or the broader global culture even. And It's kind of like a black market with higher aspirations. That's sort of I think a phrase that I used in there, where it's there is this utopia involved. There is this idea that there's a this bigger thing that can be created, where you're using the sort of the social networks of the counterculture to generate new ideas and to generate sort of new income and new wisdom and new businesses, and that gets very complicated now in the 21st century. It was kind of I feel like the lines were maybe a little bit more clear then. But hip capitalism is more like, I guess, you know, thinking about something like, you know, Madison, you know, advertising in the 60s, pulling in, you know, the psychedelic vocabulary to advertise things, or to, you know, think about, you know, major labels signing bands, or I guess the Dead did that too, but sort of integrating the signs and symbols of psychedelia into a more traditional form of capitalism, and a more traditional forms of business. Whereas hip economics is kind of about using psychedelics and using rock and roll to fund something that's sort of actively counter to that, or actively parallel to that.
Yeah, I think another dimension of the hip capitalism, to make that distinction, stay with that distinction, that goes beyond the sort of way it gets incorporated in, say, traditional advertising, or even in terms of maybe individuals using it to like help their own, you know, companies by having a better vision of it or whatever, which is fine, is the way, is what you and I'm glad you included this in your book. While you're not largely acting as a kind of really critical of the scene, you do oftentimes add nice little bits to remind everybody that there's, you know, issues of privilege and difficult issues of capitalism. But you talk about the California ideology, this idea that
right. One
of the things we're witnessing now is that we're inside of this weird mutant fusion of a kind of libertarian capitalism in some ways that wants to be freed from state control and kind of wants to be let alone to do what it wants to do and is changing traditional work modes, moving us into a more temporary economy where everything is fluctuating and a lot of workers don't have the kind of reliable sources of income or 401ks or health plans, and we're all kind of in this much more like mobile, flexible mindscape. And on the one hand you have that, and then you have the way in which hippie ideas, you know, whether it's through Google or through Apple or just a kind of general incorporation of some of this hip economics, has kind of fused. And it's a very, again, like being a countercultural identified person who has, you know, a political brain, it's a really complicated and sometimes very confusing and sometimes disappointing point that I think we find ourselves in, where there's some people who are, you know, you could tell the story of Burning Man, which you also talk about in very similar ways in terms of how what once was definitely the most countercultural radical thing going on in psychedelic America for many, many years is also now kind of incorporated in this sort of bizarre, alternately exciting and disturbing kind of way. And the way in which you trace that's my question as I do my roundabout way of asking questions. That's kind of my style here, is the question of free. And you do a wonderful job throughout the book of talking about how the idea of free changes when you go back from the diggers in the hate in the late 60s, when the free meant like free food and free clothes and really being free also socially, sexually, etc. And then the way in which that idea gets changed and reframed, you know, throughout the 70s and 80s as it goes into the exchange of tape cassettes about the dead, about how dead shows get taped, and then the taper networks form and the importance of those being free, and how that sets up in turn certain internet related ideas about the value of free, whether it's through MP3s or through the way in which these kinds of non-commodified communities build up. And so you have this very positive utopian story about free that's really important, and then at the end you have this extra little thing about how, well, free doesn't quite mean the same thing anymore, because, you know, free used to be like free tape for you, and now it's like, yeah, it's free for you, but only as long as you give us your marketing information so we can continue to track you. And of course that's
right.
What the freeness of the internet is it's free because I'm a bee and it's a wasp, it's a flower, it's an orchid, it's using my freeness to do something that is very different than that digger spirit of free. So I'd again love to hear you reflect a little bit, even personally for you, how complicated free has become despite this wonderful utopian line that has brought us from the diggers through into the internet.
Yeah, I mean it's so conflicting, and it's so bizarro to have, you know, the, sort of the whole notion of the gift economy kind of, or, you know, whatever, you know, lingo you want to use to describe sort of that turn. But on the other hand, the thing that I do keep coming back to is that while that sort of public definition of free continues to change, that sort of that digger's message of free, I think actually is really fundamentally the same, which is that they were kind of doing all of these things to sort of illustrate, you know, free is up to the individual. It's not, you know, it's, you know, yes, there are, you know, these objects that you can give away, and yes, you can give away free food, and yes, that can be, you know, this political philosophy. But the whole idea that they were trying to sort of open people up to was that it was about the freedom of individuals to decide to be what they thought of as free or think of as free. And that part is still, you know, that's still completely universal. It's, you know, you can give all your information to Google, you can give all, you know, you can surrender completely to the dystopia, but you still have that relationship with yourself kind of at the core of it. And I think that's what I kept coming back to personally, just both as, you know, an American citizen and as somebody who, you know, from time to time engages with psychedelics. And it's, you know, it's up to me and it's up to you and it's up to whoever. And I think that is sort of, I think that these are all sort of navigation tools. You know, there's no, it is completely, you know, this conflict of free where there are all these, where there's all this data and all this information attached and all these sort of, you know, terms and conditions. Like there, you know, it seems like there, you know, free has an end user license agreement now, that kind of thing. And I feel like psychedelics in that sense are, and the sort of psychedelic spirituality and the psychedelic religion are all kind of sort of tools to investigate that and to sort of figure out what you do identify with or don't identify with and what your, you know, what your guiding compass is.
Yeah. I think that's really wonderfully said. I just want to quote, like in the literally the last paragraph of the book, you write that the idea of privacy becomes a cosmic joke in our contemporary era. All the more reason to quest for true inner freedom, away from cyberspace's panopticon of searchlights. Dystopia is here in full, but only for those who want it. So, and there is a sense, and I've thought about that, of like, wow, a lot of parts of my life that I used to think of as being sort of private, as part of the kind of meaningful home that I have built, whether it's through friendships or culture that I enjoy or whatever, a lot of that has sort of changed. It's been reframed and it's been kind of drawn into these larger, nameless, often invisible networks that I don't quite feel as home as I used to because of this loss of privacy. I'm old enough to really notice that difference in a way that I think people, especially people younger than you, are really just a different world for them. I can't speak for them. But for me, it has thrown me back on this question of like, well, I know that there's something else about what freedom is or awareness or outside of capitalism or whatever I want to think about it that has to do with these very profound inner experiences that aren't just my inner experiences, like I'm a solitary individual, but resonate with these other experiences of other people.
Sorry.
No problem. And I think that's a really key line that you know, that you trace and you keep returning to. So what is your sense about how these things are meaningful for people now or are used by people now, especially younger people, especially the microdosing, you know, programmers and the people who are using it in different kinds of scenes, maybe far away from the dead, about how the meaning of LSD or meaning of these experiences is changing, maybe is moving away from some of the currents that you talk about? Or do you see more of a continuity of questions and humor and celebration?
I mean, I do see a continuity between, and you know, but it's so wide, and the breadth of usage is still so wide that I think there can be both of those things, that there can be this continuity between people who are using it to, you know, for spiritual purposes or the, you know, purposes of sort of spiritual seeking, and people who are using it for fun, and people who are using it for creativity. And I don't think any of those things are sort of mutually exclusive. I do think a lot of people are still using it as kind of like an escape or an alternate path, an entrance to a world that is not the same as the mainstream culture that they participate in. You know, because psychedelics are illegal and still, you know, pretty profoundly illegal, they're still, you know, Schedule I drugs. There is that sort of outlaw sense that goes along with their consumption that I think would be very different if they were made legal. And I think that, you know, that's a question that I think that comes up a lot with me, that I think about a lot in terms of marijuana use as so many states go green and it becomes sort of this legal, normalized part of the economy. You know, that individual relationship with the material becomes different as it becomes more integrated into the society as a whole. And I don't think psychedelics are probably going to become fully accepted in the same way that marijuana kind of is on the path to, it seems like. But I think that does change things a little bit there. But then I also think about sort of going back to kind of those early sort of the when LSD was legal in the, you know, pre-1965, sort of some of the usages that were going on then. Things like Myron Solaroff's International Foundation for Advanced Studies or whatever in Menlo Park, where you have these, you know, businessmen basically using it to as kind of a sort of a new mode of thought. There are stories about, you know, the engineers at Ampex, you know, going off on a group retreat and taking LSD together to sort of improve creativity, which is kind of like, it seems like the path, you know, one of the paths that we're kind of almost on now back with microdosing. But there, you know, there was a lot of attention to that in the early 60s, LSD being used as a catalyst for creativity. There's that, I guess, that sort of famous or infamous Frank Barron study about it, you know, connecting LSD to architecture and, you know, all these things. So I think that notion of using LSD to become a more productive member of society has always sort of been there. And I think now it's sort of becoming an open question again.
Oh, great.
That's really interesting to me. It's sort of coming full circle back to that.
Yeah, not to mention the sort of larger, more, you know, goofy Terrence McKenna influenced sort of notion that in some vaguer way that the experience itself, the multiplicity, the cartoon echo chamber, the liquidness of ideas and memory and perception. The sort of resonating multidimensional cosmic echo chamber of the thing somehow prepares one for the overwhelming bizarreness of being in a, you know, digital society where the distinctions between geography and information are breaking down, where you can't go by geography anymore, even if it's the fantastic geography of the Humbeads map. Where it's something else is happening that is, you know, very difficult to just handle existentially, culturally in some ways, and that there's some sort of resonance there. And, you know, even McLuhan talked about this in the 60s, that LSD was sort of a way of navigating or responding to the emerging electromagnetic universe that he saw back then that was so much simpler than our world. Today we have about 10 minutes left here, and I wanted to ask you one other question. That's something that I think about a lot. I read, you know, Steve Silberman is a guy who's been on the show. He's a friend of mine, a wonderful chronicler of the dead, and he appears in your book a lot. And he wrote a review of your book, and the one quibble he had was that there's so little about Black America. And it's a very complicated question, and I'm not asking you or accusing you of not having done your homework, because it's a tough question. I've looked at it myself, and there's a lot of issues that it raises, a lot of complicated issues about the resistance, the legitimate resistance that a lot of African Americans had towards psychedelics in the 60s and 70s. And at the same time, there is these interesting currents. That's not really the question I want to ask you, because it's a complicated one. The question I do want to ask you, though, is the flip side, which is one thing that I keep coming back to, is that, like, this is white culture in many ways, not in a way of saying we're claiming it or saying that people who are Asian or Hispanic or Black or whatever don't have as much a right to be a deadhead. It's not at all what I mean. But when I think about whiteness as a white person, and I see all the horrible ways that reactionaries are trying to shore up the idea of whiteness and defend white culture, you know, the Trump and all that stuff. And, you know, it makes me sick. I don't want to have anything to do with that kind of racialism at all. And yet there's this weird question. Well, what does it mean to be white? What does it mean to have white culture? Can we ask those questions? And it's a dangerous question in some ways, but when I ask it to myself, my first answer is like, yeah, it's hippie culture, man. That's where I'm like, okay, being like, this is kind of a white culture with all the qualifications. And I'm okay with that. Like, I'm okay feeling like that's like, you can have your cowboy rodeo thing, or you can have your old school Nordic Aryan, but whatever. I'm not into that at all, but this one I'm okay with. And I'm curious whether that also was something that you were thinking about, you know, looking at just how much appeal psychedelics have, particularly for white people, also for men in a lot of ways. But that's another question. There's tons of women in the scene. You know, it's not even close. But when you look at the demographics, it skews, you know, young white male. But but really thinking more about whiteness and what it means to be a white person in America and how psychedelics have kind of offered some kind of space of doing something different than the creepy shit that these so many conservatives are foisting on us.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that has to do with sort of the moment and places where psychedelics first appeared in this culture. And I think, you know, there is that part of white American culture that is to feel conflicted about being, you know, a colonial settler on a continent that had, you know, thousands of years of culture there before it. And, you know, there is a lot of conflict in, you know, being a white person in a society where slavery used to be legal. And I think psychedelics and counterculture are, I mean, you know, they're used different ways, and it's kind of an eye of the beholder kind of thing. Whereas, you know, for some people, it is that way of making a space that is better and is idealistic and does serve a greater purpose and does acknowledge, you know, sort of, you know, you know, bigger things. But there's also the aspect of psychedelics that, you know, the Ken Kesey phrase, you know, turn your back and say fuck it, where it's you're going away, you're escaping from the dominant culture because you have the privilege of being able to escape from the dominant culture. And, you know, it is something I think about, it is something that I'm conflicted about, and it's not anything I have any real answers to other than that I do feel like sort of the head scene or the hippie scene or the counterculture is basically, you know, a benevolent force in the universe that has done a lot of good and does, you know, produces things that are not conflicted, that produces things that are, you know, that connects humans to other humans. I think a lot of it does have to do with the fact that psychedelics made it into American culture in the 60s through, you know, really through university and, you know, college and college culture. And that was sort of the initial way that it spread. And I think that's sort of one of the reasons why it's so ingrained in that part of the world. In a way, you know, you can look at other substances like, you know, marijuana. You wouldn't say that it's predominantly a white drug. It's definitely something that crosses boundaries in American culture very, very deeply. And I, you know, psychedelics are kind of available for people who have the space to use them, and that's, you know, having you know, the ability to have, you know, 8 to 12 hours to do something is something that not everybody has, you know, and it's a complicated thing.
Yeah. Well, thanks for taking the tough question. Again, I just want to say that you do a good job in the book. While that's not your goal to critique this current, you want to put it forward in its positivity and its complexity, but you do a good job of reminding the reader along the way about how certain things are, you know, do sound like forms of privilege, or they are blinkered in certain ways. And I think it's important to say that partly as a way to you know, to bring more intelligence into the ongoing scene rather than to sit outside of it and to write it off and say, like a lot of the critics of the California ideology go, okay, well, because the California ideology has changed the world in these dystopian ways, anything associated with these hippie ideas that have been absorbed into it are somehow corrupt or bankrupt, or we have to, you know, ignore them anymore, which is just, to my mind, a terribly simplistic and parochial even a way to think about things. It's a lot more complicated than that. We just have a couple of questions left, and I guess I'm saying, if you imagine, you know, let's say you're putting out another edition of this book in 10 years, and that means there's going to be another chapter now after the last chapter, what's going to be in that first chapter? What's happening right now that feels fresh or interesting, or where you would continue this telling the story forward, if you will, looking towards 2020?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the really fascinating things that's going on right now is this kind of integration between all these different parts of the psychedelic world that had kind of been separate for a long time, where we now do have this revival in research that's been going on over the last 10 years, where people are now doing kind of the first basic research that kind of you know, should have been going, you know, should have been going on in the 60s, you know, creating pilot studies to, you know, investigate what LSD and what mushrooms and what all these things do to people. But there's also a lot of new emphasis, it seems like, on integration and integration circles and sort of using these substances in sort of responsible ways. And just sort of, you know, I was out in California a month or so ago doing, you know, promoting the book, and just sort of seeing the way that psychedelics are really, it seems like, integrating into kind of that new, you know, the new California moment that always seems to be happening. And, you know, the vocabulary is seems to be slowly mutating and changing. You know, it seems like people don't quite trip as much as they used to. They now take journeys. There's definitely a new model of shamanism going on out there that's sort of becoming, in some places that I encountered, kind of inseparable from sort of psychedelic psychiatry, something like that, where sort of the shamans and psychiatrists are literally one in the same person. And I'm not trying to come to any judgment on that quite yet, but it's definitely, it seems like a move in some ways back towards kind of the guru culture of the 60s that I think psychedelics kind of escaped in the 70s and 80s to some extent. But yeah, there are really just so many pieces going on right now that it's hard to see any kind of like one big thread. But I've seen sort of the boundaries fall down between these sort of different pockets of psychedelic users is really encouraging and interesting to see.
Great. Well, I think we're going to have to wrap it up there. And I guess to say one other thing, I'm really glad that your book exists partly to give some real substance to that non-guru line of, you know, existential psychedelic spirituality. So thank you for that. And once again, we're talking with Jesse Jarno about Heads, Biography of Psychedelic America. Jesse, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Cool. Thank you so much, Eric. I had a lot of fun.
Okay. I don't know who we're going to talk to next week, but tune in to find out. Until then, keep your minds open.